Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 9th, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we will be discussing Bitcoin. What is it? What and how should it be treated legally? I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and, as is typically the case, we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome today not only a special guest moderator, but two other experts on our topic. I'm going to introduce all three and then turn things over to our moderator. Our experts are Jim Harper. He's with the Global Policy. He is the Global Policy Counsel at the Bitcoin Foundation, and he's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. We also have with us today Chip Ponce. He's co-founder of the Financial Integrity Network and former senior advisor at the U.S. Department of Treasury, where from 2000 to 2013, he held various senior positions. And our moderator, a return moderator, is Vincent J. Vitkowski. He's a partner at the Seiger Gefeller Lurie Law Firm, and he's also the chairman of the Federalist Society's International National Security Law Practice Group Executive Committee. We're very pleased to have all three with us today. We will ultimately, as always, be turning to the audience for your questions, so please do be ready with your questions. And with that, Vince Vitkowski, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Our format today will be straightforward, with first Jim Harper, then Chip Ponce making some opening remarks of about 10 minutes each. Then they'll have an interchange with each other for about 5 to 7 minutes. I may have a few questions, and then we'll be sure to have time to turn it over to the audience for whatever questions come from them. So with that, and without further ado, Jim Harper.
Thank you, Vince, and I want to just give my thanks to the Federalist Society, Dean Reuter, everybody who's tuning in. I think these kinds of sessions are very valuable and interesting, and I hope will be interesting, too. Thanks to you, Chip, also for joining the conversation. I thought I'd start by going into what Bitcoin is, doing a little bit deeper dive than maybe most people have so far. I'm not going to go all the way in because we have limited time, and I have limited competence to explain Bitcoin all the way through to the cryptography. The short version of Bitcoin is that it's online money. It has lots of the properties of cash, but it can be fully transferred online. But I think a better way to start thinking about Bitcoin is to understand the underlying protocol. Remember that when email came out, they called it email because that metaphor is what fit the most closely. So it's like mail that we're very familiar with. But we obviously don't put things in an envelope and send them on highly inefficient trucks and those systems to get them from point A to point B. The Bitcoin protocol is basically a ledger. So think of it as a protocol for a ledger where new pages are regularly added to this ledger over time. It's a ledger that anybody can write something to and nobody can erase. It's kind of strange to think about a ledger. Why is a ledger important? Well, lots and lots of systems, information systems and others, rely on having a ledger. And basically, banking systems, payment systems are based on a ledger. So when you send money through PayPal, I send money to Chip through PayPal or something like that, there isn't actual money flowing through the internet, but rather PayPal makes a notation in its ledger. Well, the money that Jim had with us is now moved to Chip's account. And vice versa, if Chip were to send it to Jim, they make their amendment to the ledger. The Bitcoin system has a limited number of tokens that you can pass around, you can move around using this ledger. So those tokens are limited in quantity, and they have value. They have value based on the consensus of Bitcoin users that they have value. That's kind of a strange thing, and I think a lot of people who are just starting to think about money and think about these issues find it strange, the assertion that these notations, digital notations, or control over digital bits is actually valuable like money. But just remember, one of the basic elements of economics is the subjective theory of value. That is, people decide the things that they value, and they value things based on the idea, often correct, that other people will value them, and you can trade them for something. So it can be that people regard Bitcoins, the ability to control entries in this ledger, as a valuable thing, and they can use it as money if they want to. The number of Bitcoins that are in existence will max out at 21 million or so in about 2140, 126 years from now or so. And the rate of creation of new Bitcoins will decline steadily over that time. It's a slightly inflationary currency at this point, but over time it will become a non-inflationary currency or a deflationary currency, if you care to consider it that way. I won't go into the cryptography, but it's a system that appears very strong in terms of maintenance of the ledger, so that it can't be broken, it can't be changed by bad actors. It's very unlikely that anyone would be able to attack the ledger and change the entries in it. So it's a very interesting, very strong protocol. I think it's fascinating to study in and of itself. Of course, the killer app for this protocol is transfer of money, as we talked about. And actually, while I was considering joining the Bitcoin Foundation, which I joined in March, I sort of did a poll of the leadership of the foundation, its board members, its key staff, and members of the leaders of its committees, because I wanted to understand the foundation very well. I wanted to understand what Bitcoin's all about very well. And I found four major motivations, things that people want and expect to have happen based on Bitcoin. And the number one, far and away actually, was the idea of promoting global financial inclusion. I think if you stop and think about it, it's rather striking that in this day and age, something like half of the world's people don't have access to formal financial services. That means that they can't put money into a bank and expect it to remain there. That means that they can't make payments like we can using credit cards or checks or other things. They don't have these basic economic conveniences that many of us take for granted. And that disables them from bettering their lives in whatever way they wish. And it's a little bit galling. And sometimes I've been in sort of guilt-lined rooms talking about Bitcoin. I say, look around you. Most of the world doesn't have this, and they probably could. Global financial inclusion is something that a lot of Bitcoiners think is very important, and the potential is there, even if Bitcoin adds a small degree to people's access to economic services like this. That would be a good thing. Another thing that people see coming out of the use of Bitcoin is enhanced liberty and dignity. There is dignity in having your own assets, in being able to deploy them as you wish, not subject to the whim or will of overbearing governments or of criminals and the criminal element. So putting people in a position, this is not entirely distinct from the global financial inclusion idea, putting people in a position to run their lives, to own their lives, to generate wealth, to own property, all these things are things that people hope for coming out of successful Bitcoin adoption. Another priority of Bitcoiners, another potential from Bitcoin, is referred to often as user-defined privacy. There's a fair argument, and maybe a quite good argument, that financial privacy in the United States and financial privacy around the world is perhaps honored in the breach. We have very little privacy when we transact. Not because of any malevolent purpose in the design of our financial services systems, but because they are centralized systems that have built up over time, and for convenience, largely, they don't have strong privacy protections. People would like to have privacy. They'd like to make sure that if they use Bitcoin, their income can't necessarily be revealed just because they spend some money. There's a way I'll talk about it in just a second. How that can happen currently in the Bitcoin network. Today, your financial privacy is dictated essentially by corporations and governments, and I think a lot of people would like to have a little more control over their own information about their financial transactions. A final outcome that people seek from Bitcoin is a stable money supply, chiefly in countries that don't have it. There are countries around the globe that the U.S. and Europe and the major Asian countries have a pretty stable money supply, though some have their doubts about the long-term viability of the money supply in those countries. But in countries around the world in the Southern Hemisphere, where money is where the national currencies are poorly managed, Bitcoin offers a way out for people so that the value they've accrued in their lives isn't inflated away, isn't devalued whole cloth by the local government. Will all these things happen? I think they might happen in some margin. Bitcoin has been subject to a lot of hype in the recent past and a lot of overstatement. I risk constantly overstating myself the benefits of Bitcoin, but I hope for all these things to happen in the right measures around the world. Most likely, Bitcoin will be adopted in countries that need it most. That's not necessarily the U.S. and the West. It may well be that countries that have enough internet access to support Bitcoin and a paucity of healthy financial services and payment systems. So that may be some countries in South America, like Argentina, maybe places in Africa or Asia, that where the right mix is in place, the need for better financial services and sufficient internet access for the people there. Meanwhile, businesses in the U.S. and around the world are trying to figure out how to satisfy those needs, and that's an important part of the puzzle that is still just coming into place, the business models that will serve people, the technology that will make Bitcoin easy to use, et cetera, et cetera. Before I conclude, I'll just go a little bit into the tension between privacy and law enforcement that I think Chip might focus on or anticipate, perhaps. And there is one. There may be from Bitcoin a rebalancing or a struggle to define how the privacy law enforcement trade-offs should be calibrated. It's true that use of Bitcoin can produce greater privacy, and I think in the early going, a lot of people referred to it as anonymous with some lack of care. I originally thought it was anonymous, but as I studied how the network works, I realized it's at best pseudonymous, and it provides if you are seeking anonymity in the use of Bitcoin, your anonymity can be very brittle. That is, you might be able to keep people from knowing your transactions, but once one of them is discovered, it could be that all of them or most of them are discovered, so your anonymity rather will fall apart. That's because every transaction on the Bitcoin ledger is part of this public ledger. It's all up on the internet. It's the basic way that Bitcoin works is to publish transactions on the ledger. Likewise, the businesses that work in Bitcoin, we believe at the foundation, are subject to the same laws as businesses that provide financial services in non-Bitcoin currencies, U.S. dollars, euros, or whatever it may be. So there are plenty of touch points where anti-money laundering requirements, know your customer requirements, and other things are in place, and so that will provide law enforcement some ongoing capability. It's been said that people originally thought Bitcoin was a magic cloak for criminality, but it's not. And in fact, the problem for Bitcoin may be that the threats to privacy in Bitcoin are too great. We may need to take steps to make sure that ordinary people in their day-to-day transactions don't reveal too much about their private financial information. So the law enforcement and privacy trade-off will be different in the future, but I don't think it's necessarily harder for law enforcement to do what we want law enforcement to do in the Bitcoin environment. So I'll conclude there and look forward to Chip's presentation and back and forth and discussion. Thanks very much.
Go ahead, Chip.
Thank you, Vince. Thank you, Jim. I thought Jim's comments were terrific, and I shouldn't be surprised by that. I've had the privilege of listening to Jim on other panels, and he always is an informative and educational voice on these issues. So, Jim, thanks for introducing and going first, and for agreeing to participate with me on today's session. Vince, thanks for hosting it, and the Federalist Society for putting it together, Dean and David, for setting this up and for introducing us. I wanted to just outline, for purposes of hopefully stimulating some conversation, some background context on the perspective of government from combating illicit finance and how that perspective has intersected with Bitcoin most prevalently over the past year. And with that, hopefully invite a conversation on what are clear challenges that are emerging about how best to assimilate or integrate Bitcoin into the regulated financial system for purposes of helping our authorities combat a full range of illicit financing activity. That context, I think, begins with an acknowledgement that we are, at the moment, living in incredibly exciting times for not just Bitcoin, but financial governance and the potential for, on the one hand, tremendous exposure and instability and risk associated with an increasingly complex and intermediate global financial system, and on the other hand, opportunity to use the information and the relationships that the financial system offers to better protect us and to help our authorities identify illicit activities and illicit proceeds that traverse the globe. And that that opportunity and vulnerability has led to, I think, a growing recognition of the importance of our efforts as a global society to combat the biggest threats that we face, not just in our national security, but to a global security, with financial information and financial action. And I think that's evident even to the most casual observers when you look at the headlines from the past several years. And I know in my experience in the government, having joined soon after the terrorist attacks 9/11, there was a fairly immediate recognition of the value of financial information and action in combating the terrorist threat that we all face globally, and that in order to best harness the information and the support of the financial system, we needed to think as a global community about a unified approach in a global system that was increasingly integrated financially and across a variety of threats, where the commonality is the need for financial services and financial support by criminal organizations of all stripes. So whether you're a terrorist organization or whether you're a drug trafficking organization or whether you are an illicit procurement network financing nuclear or missile development programs in Iran or North Korea, or whether you are evading systematically taxes and tax collection by various authorities, or whether you are absconding with assets from countries from Libya to Iraq to Ukraine, that there is an underlying need, an increasing reliance on financial information and action to help our global community combat that full range of threats. And that has given, great opportunity for us to think about financial information and action in a way that that we haven't historically. And at the same time, it's also raised the cost of inaction to the extent that we don't take advantage of the information and the opportunities that financial relationships present. Then we continue to fall victim to nefarious organizations that do take advantage of the services that have grown around our financial system in order to facilitate the full spectrum of organized crime. So that's some context on the growth of a counter-illicit finance approach and regime over the past several years, both out of necessity and out of opportunity. And as that's happened, I think there have been a number of challenges that I would look at in a couple of different envelopes. The first is how you integrate a counter-illicit finance perspective, broadly speaking, into a broader approach to managing and participating in the financial system. There are a number of different financial governance and financial interests in gaining access to financial services and in trying to manage that, and they span basic prudential, safety, soundness, stability interests that seek to prevent the types of calamities that we witnessed in 2008 with the financial crisis. They include consumer protection and investor protection interests, and they also include tax collection and counter-illicit finance interests. And we're seeing a convergence of those different interests around the need for basic financial transparency, to understand, as a financial system, which actors are participating in the system, sources of funds, destinations of funds, both with respect to who's involved and what those financial transactions relate to in terms of activities. And those basic interests of financial transparency attend the full spectrum of financial governance interests and concerns. And with that context, when you look at a technology like Bitcoin, there can be a couple of different reactions to this, right? There can be the reaction that this is a threat to the financial transparency that we rely upon increasingly to manage the interests I've tried to describe in governing a financial system that's increasingly complicated. Or there can be optimism about the opportunity that Bitcoin presents to facilitate, as Jim's outlined, a number of different interests that are consistent with the very reasons for constructing a financial system. And that includes accelerating financial inclusion, as Jim's described. That includes facilitating the sorts of services that the financial system provides to those that do have access. But it also relies upon a certain degree of trust when you participate in that system, that your information, as Jim has described, is not abused, but also trust that in participating in that system, you do not seek to abuse the system, either as a sector, a technology, an industry, an actor, or an individual. And so, you know, with that background, that backdrop, when you look at Bitcoin and you have this potential reaction of this is a threat and a potential reaction of this is an opportunity, I think that sets the stage for much of the discussion that's attended Bitcoin to date, and would just offer that I think for most who have participated in these discussions, the inevitable conclusion in my mind is that Bitcoin is, in fact, becoming assimilated into the regulated financial system. As Jim's alluded to, there are rules on the books, there are requirements in place to regulate Bitcoin and to protect it, as well as to protect the financial system from illicit activity that may be occurring through Bitcoin. These protections and requirements are not bulletproof for Bitcoin or for any other aspect of the financial system. But that process of applying these pre-existing requirements to Bitcoin is an ongoing one. So while initial steps have been taken, additional steps will have to be taken. And the challenge for us, I think, is to make sure that as we work to incorporate Bitcoin into the financial system, that we do it in a way that is consistent with the principles of financial transparency and yet not insensitive to some of the peculiarities and the particular characteristics of Bitcoin so that we don't choke off some of the purposes that Jim's alluded to, even with the best of intentions. And that's a challenge that in order to address, we're going to need leadership from the industry, we're going to need leadership from those in financial governance, and we're going to need leadership from those other financial industries that Bitcoin is interacting with. And I'm happy to say that I think to date, we're seeing more and more of that, but there's a lot of work ahead. Vince, I'm sorry. That's that'll do it for me for an introduction.
Okay. Jim, well, anything you'd like to?
Yeah, I'll just take a couple of minutes and rejoin a theme that I take from what Chip said. And I appreciate your presentation, Chip, and a very interesting perspective. A theme I take from it is one that actually Senator Carper, I think, produced when he had a very good hearing on Bitcoin last fall, I think in November. It's my characterization of his theme is that you know he wants the government, the government policy to go after getting the benefits of Bitcoin and a vibrant U.S. Bitcoin ecosystem while mitigating the risks. And that's sort of a theme I heard in what Chip was saying too, is that the benefits are significant. I think there's a lot of room for innovation in financial services in the United States. A lot of room for new competition to entrenched incumbents, and even if Bitcoin doesn't succeed, the threat of Bitcoin is already, I think, starting to get some of the large financial services providers to think again about how they provide services. Why does it take 2 days, 3 days to do an ACH transaction and have it delivered? Should it really cost $2.50, $3 to get some cash out of your ATM, et cetera, et cetera? Those are the things we're familiar with. the cost of credit card payments is very high, and retailers are not at all satisfied with paying 2%, 2.5%, which is sometimes that's equal to or greater than their profit margins, their net profits on payments. They're spending that much money. So if they can lower their cost of payments, they'll raise their profits, and in competitive markets, those benefits will also pass on to consumers in the form of lower prices. Absolutely, issues like financial stability and consumer protection are in play. I think of Bitcoin, a lot of people going too far too fast talk about whether or not Bitcoin will topple a major currency or something like that, and that's a bit far-fetched and certainly off on a far horizon at best. I think about Bitcoin as an alternative that people can use if they are in an environment where they're that is financially unstable. Mostly that's countries in the Southern Hemisphere that don't have well-managed financial systems. But the existence of a competing monetary system in the U.S., in Europe, and elsewhere may cause central banks to be more circumspect in what they're doing, to work harder, a competitive spur that causes them to be more careful. So Bitcoin is an entrant into the financial services world that even if it does nothing else, it serves as this competitive spur that I think will probably improve performance across a variety of domains. The consumer protection area is particularly interesting because there are lots of things that ordinary consumers don't understand about the financial services that they work with today, and we have a large and growing regulatory superstructure that hasn't seemed to really deliver consumer protection. And I think that the 2008 financial crisis, was an example of where we already had a heavily regulated financial services system, and yet this happened. No argument that Bitcoin is some kind of snap of the fingers that solves all that, but there's great potential in Bitcoin for what you'd call programmable money and programmable contracts, so that consumers can be, they don't have to trust, they don't have to rely on government oversight in given transactions. There might be computer programs that show them affirmatively using cryptographic proof that they've received satisfactory services. There are companies already that are providing cryptographic proof of assets, so that they claim they have this much, these many assets on hand. You don't have to rely on what they say. You don't have to rely on what an auditor says. They have cryptographic proof. Now, I'm not the cryptographer who can take you through and understand that, so I do rely on cryptographers who follow the things closely. But these are some ways that consumer protection will differ and perhaps improve in the Bitcoin environment. I feel like I've gone long, so I'll just stop there. But I'm sure there's lots of interesting things for us to talk about.
Chip.
Ben, thanks. I'd love to open it up for any questions. Before I do,
yeah.
and again, agree with what Jim said. Maybe just to color in a little bit more, and looking at what are the issues coming down the road and. What should we be thinking about now, given the context that we've tried to provide? I think there are two challenges/opportunities of particular interest. One is, it stems from acknowledgement that as important as the interests that I've tried to describe are in facilitating financial transparency so that we can understand and manage risk in the system for the benefit of everyone, consumers, investors, ordinary citizens, combating, again, the full range of risks that attend the financial system. We are far from perfect in how we govern and how we attempt to achieve that financial transparency. 2008 is an easy example, but there are inefficiencies throughout our financial system. As products, as players, as governors, there are all sorts of inefficiencies, and I agree with Jim that Bitcoin is going to stimulate in a competitive way, I think, some reconsideration from a number of different players on how they offer their services, what kind of services are available, and ultimately make the financial system more efficient. That's certainly a huge attraction. I think there's also an opportunity, though, with Bitcoin to, and maybe the Bitcoin folks will find this frustrating. Maybe they'll find this encouraging. but an opportunity through Bitcoin to take a run at some issues that require some rethinking outside of the Bitcoin space. So where Bitcoin has been regulated, most predominantly globally and certainly in the U.S., is with respect to its functionality as a money transmitter. And that set of regulatory requirements stems from the counter-illicit finance regime. So the requirements that have been imposed on Bitcoin and other digital currency players are requirements that emanate from our interest in combating illicit finance. They're not requirements that emanate from our interest in taxing assets or interest in protecting investors, consumers, or security holders. They, or as a depository instrument, they're interests that stem from our counter-illicit financing concerns. And in the money transmitter space, there are huge challenges in how we think about our regulations, our requirements, from a policy perspective to an operational reality, not just in the U.S. but globally. How do you extend requirements over money transmitters writ large, whether they're terrestrial like Western Union, virtual like Bitcoin, in a way that's meaningful, effective, and efficient? You know, this is a real struggle for those in government, for those in the industry, for those in the U.S., and for those abroad, whether you're in a remitting market or whether you're in an accepting market. And Bitcoin has an opportunity to maybe force or facilitate a conversation about whether we're doing it the right way. And what has traditionally been viewed as a transactional industry, whether there is some merit in thinking through more of an ongoing relationship with customers in a way that will help us service them better and identify and manage risk more effectively. So that's one opportunity that I think exists, is for Bitcoin to prompt a broader discussion on how we expand our effectiveness in managing the money transmission universe that they've been categorized as. The other is an opportunity in the Bitcoin space to think about how regulation can level the playing field in a constructive way for digital currencies that at the moment is a fairly fractured environment from what I can tell, and I'll defer to Jim all day on this. I'm not an expert on digital currency or Bitcoin, but it appears that, and understandably, that there's a host of divergent interests across that field of digital currencies. And for those industry players that are interested in all of the legitimate purposes that Jim has outlined, to use the inevitability of regulation as an opportunity to try to consolidate the voice of that industry around those interests that are legitimate, which are overwhelming in this space, but where there may be interests that are at odds with the transparency that we require or the regulatory oversight that is needed to protect the interests that we've described, and to use this inevitable integration as an opportunity to mature the industry a bit for purposes of then informing government on how best to extend oversight, regulation, et cetera, and integrate Bitcoin into. So I would just offer those two challenges as maybe grounds for discussion from listeners. Thanks, Vince.
Thanks. Well, let me kick off the questions with the following. The discussion has been at really the 10,000-foot level, and you do paint some broad contours, and I thank you for that. When you get a little closer to the ground, there's an awful lot of, I guess I could call it, challenging complexity associated with Bitcoin. If I were being blunter, I'd say, you know, confusion. And I'm just going to throw out, a couple of examples and maybe ask you to respond to any of the points or questions or suggestions or, you know, raised that you'd like. I mean, the first, on a regulatory level, there's no one really knows what to do with it, right? Within the Treasury Department, there are two different agencies who've taken sort of two different approaches. The FinCEN, treating it like money for the purpose of licensing money exchangers. The IRS treating it as property, for taxation purposes. Similarly, the Federal Election Commission is now sitting on a request from a PEC for an advisory opinion on what to do with what it can do with Bitcoin contributions. And the understanding is that the FEC has two separate draft opinions at odds with each other. They don't know whether to treat Bitcoin as subject to the restrictions on in-kind contributions or those on cash contributions, $100 limit. So people are really struggling with that. Next point, neither of you mentioned the I would call it extreme volatility and the fluctuation in the price of Bitcoin, which can be unsettling for anybody really trying to use it for basic commerce. I'd like to hear some comments on that. Next, it's more of an aside, but when you deal with cybersecurity issues, these days you're also dealing with cyber extortionists. And I think it's just interesting to note that the currency of choice for cyber extortionists is Bitcoin. That's how they want to be paid. So I'll stop with those three points and ask for some reaction from either Jim or Chip or both.
Jim here. I'll be happy to start. I thought of, as you're talking about challenging complexity, I thought of making the joke, well, the challenging complexity is not with Bitcoin. The challenging complexity is with the regulatory regimes as they exist. And the more I thought about it, the more accurate I think that probably actually is. It's true that FinCEN guidance treats Bitcoin as money. IRS guidance treats Bitcoin as property. Partially that's a product of Bitcoin's versatility. It actually has the qualities of both in different uses. And there might be Bitcoin-based products that are securities, that are commodities, that are derivatives, and in each relevant case, they would fall under different regulatory jurisdictions. Of course, we also have state-level regulation, and so the complexities are compounded. I'll say again, by the regulation, not by Bitcoin. An update on the Federal Election Commission: they actually ruled yesterday in favor of allowing Bitcoin contributions to campaigns. The request was made, the request they were responding to in their guidance was only asking to accept $100 or less, so they weren't faced with a maybe more challenging question whether they could accept higher value donations of Bitcoin. But that there are now Bitcoin donations, and one member of Congress, Jared Polis, it promptly started accepting Bitcoin contributions. You really hit on two key issues with respect to Bitcoin adoption, and those are the two, I think, two very serious impediments. Volatility is quite high today. The price of Bitcoin against established currencies fluctuates rather dramatically over time. I mean, at the present time. Over time, you can expect Bitcoin's volatility to drop as markets deepen, as sophisticated financial products come online to hedge the risk of price volatility. So, people's acceptance of Bitcoin will rise as volatility drops, and that's really just a function of time. There's not a lot you can do about it. There are businesses now that accept that risk. They take that risk and they take care of it for merchants, say, that want to accept Bitcoin. So they will receive the Bitcoin on behalf of the merchant and provide the merchant with dollars straight away. No risk of volatility for the merchant. But if you and I holding some Bitcoin on our phone are subject to the change in Bitcoin's value or price, rather, against the dollar. Security in the holding of Bitcoin is another serious problem that people are working on now to resolve. The Mt. Gox exchange, which for a time was the largest Bitcoin exchange, didn't properly secure the Bitcoin that they held. And that was rather devastating for people who kept their Bitcoin at that exchange. It was in Japan, and its management was not up to the task of looking after data that had this kind of value. The mature companies, the more responsible companies that have sophisticated leaders that are hiring sophisticated regulatory compliance officers, they're going to do a better job. And Bitcoin allows things like multi-signature control on Bitcoins. So you could have two, three, or four requirements that two, three, or four people sign off on the movement of Bitcoin from one place to another. And that's going to provide security in the future. I don't know about the cyber extortion. That sounds a little bit like I'm aware of one virus that goes around claiming to want Bitcoin in exchange for releasing a computer from being locked up. Bitcoin is not going to be a good source of funds for those uses, because the transactions, as I said before, are in a global public ledger, and so you can actually see where Bitcoins go. After, if they've been extorted out of somebody, they can follow you indefinitely into the future. So it might not be the best opportunity for any cyber extortionists out there.
Chip, any comments?
Yeah, thanks, Vince. And again, I want to thank Jim for going first. It's always easier to go second. Three great questions, Vince, that you raise, and I'll take them in turn. First, the regulatory confusion. I agree that if at first blush you look at the conversations that are happening and the statements that are being made and the rulemakings and the guidance that have been issued or debated in over the past several months, that there is real grounds for confusion. At the same time, if you take a deeper look, I think the key to understanding what is happening is to return to the question of functionality and to recognize, as Jim again has stated, Bitcoin is different things to different people, and to the extent that it is a vehicle, a value exchange or value transfer or money transfer, then it is going to be considered for regulation under those parameters. And that's been, of course, the domain of FinCEN, where I think FinCEN has been clear and has been apparently successful in communicating to industry as a virtual currency or a cryptocurrency, whether centralized or decentralized, you may be subject to requirements that attend our money transmitters based on a number of criteria and factors that they've outlined in guidance. And in response to that guidance, and this goes back to March of last year, I believe, March 2013, there have been registrations, SAR filings, and other evidence of compliance by the industry that demonstrates that that set of actions by FinCEN has been effective in promoting regulatory integration of this space. So that's a good example. But it's not at odds with functionality, additional functionality being considered by other authorities that have responsibility for other issues. And again, I look at the IRS, and it's a fair point that they now have a notice out for comment on Bitcoin and property as an asset. And again, not dissimilar, where you can have a medium of exchange like a dollar and still an asset that gets reported on your tax return in the form of your bank holdings. So again, at sort of second glance, there's a logic to this, right, and the consistency to it that follows the functionality of the technology, Bitcoin in this instance. So I think that's hopefully a helpful principle for those that are looking at these discussions and trying to figure out what's the decoder pin, so to speak. And I think it's just returning to functionality. What is the functionality? And then that should be the basis of the discussion that folks are looking at and the players that are involved. That leads to the second point that you raised about the volatility of Bitcoin. That's an issue that implicates, in my view anyway, market integrity and the speculative sort of nature of the currency and the allowance by government for that, with the intent of stimulating innovation, which is obviously occurring, and at some point recognizing a competing interest of protecting those that are in the space through regulation of the market. And we obviously have investor and consumer and other protections that are promulgated by various financial authorities. And I do think it's inevitable that those will be extended to Bitcoin if Bitcoin is to become really an integrated part of the financial system. I think that's inevitable. It hasn't happened yet. And there are some who probably feel, and if you're a Mt. Gox depositor, you're probably one of them, that it's overdue, and there are others who probably feel that it should never happen. But I think that the overwhelming response to the volatility is that there will need to be protections put in place ultimately, I think, to protect investors and consumers. I do think additional circulation will help on the market volatility, But I also think that there are options here for potentially currencies, whether Bitcoin wants to be one of them or not, to think about ways that they can address volatility through maybe an alternative model. And Bitcoin is not asset-backed. It's, as I understand it, it's the value is determined by what the market will pay for it, which is always ultimately the only determinant that matters. But that's heavily influenced by whether or not you've got a currency, virtual or otherwise, that's really backed by something other than the full faith and credibility of those who hold it, but by those that by secondary assets. So you've got other digital currencies that I'm aware of that do have hard assets that back them and that are more stable. And it's important to consider that in the context of the bigger picture here in digital currencies writ large, that there are options if there are concerns about volatility to address those through alternative models. And Bitcoin, may ultimately do that or not. But in addition to liquidity and the depth of the market and the sophistication of financial products and then the oversight of regulation, there are business models that can address volatility as well by having hard-backed, effectively, assets underpinning the currency. On the third issue, cybersecurity and extortionists, this is an interesting question. I'm not a cyber expert by any stretch, and cyber means different things to different people. When you were describing this, Vince, I immediately thought of two things. One is the sort of hackability of Bitcoin. And this is a Mt. Gox issue, right? Where to what extent are Bitcoin administrators, exchanges, or users vulnerable to hacking and the crime of theft associated with stealing other people's Bitcoin? I think Jim's response on this is compelling, which is people may hack and they may steal, but how do you use it then? And I would be curious if Jim or Vince, you have an answer to that, or the audience. I don't know how you then use what was stolen. If everybody knows this is the Bitcoin that was stolen, they have unique tags on those Bitcoins. When they come back in the market, it's declaring yourself a thief, I imagine, because everyone knows that those aren't yours. That's how I understand the technology to work, which would then incent only those that are anarchists really to do this sort of hacking. It doesn't mean it's insignificant as a threat. Obviously, it's happened, but it does raise a question of what is the objective of that? Because it's hard for me to understand how you reintroduce stolen Bitcoin into the universe, and maybe I'm misunderstanding that. But that would be my initial take. There's a second issue that comes up with the security and criminality more broadly, which is I do think it's fair to say that Bitcoin has been a bit of a target or attraction for criminal activity, in part because it has been pseudonymous, as pseudo-anonymous, as Jim has described, and for that reason maybe has attracted transactions to settle accounts between illicit actors in the form of what we've seen with the Silk Road and the form with Bitcoin and Liberty Reserve as a digital exchange provider with an alternative digital currency, Liberty Dollars or Liberty Euros as they were calling them, where to me in retrospect it makes sense that criminals that are seeking to evade detection and have financial needs that they have to address and settle will seek to do that as efficiently and as anonymously as possible. And to the extent that you have digital currencies that offer convenience, accessibility, efficiency, and not full transparency, then they will be attractive to those that are seeking to break the law. So I think that's almost a natural association, and I think that will go away as Bitcoin is folded into and other digital currencies implement requirements that shed the transparency of regulation on the activities within those currencies. But I do think historically that's an understandable concern, and I'm of the view that it's going to go away as these exchanges and users that transact through them are subjected to greater oversight.
Thank you. We have a hard stop at 3, so Dean, I think we should see whether there are any questions from people listening in.
Sure thing. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button, and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 10 minutes left. Right now, Vince, we have one caller, so let's take that first question.
Go ahead.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Bitcoin and other digital currencies fulfill a prediction I made in the 1979 issue of The Futurist, in which I predicted that devices similar to our smartphones today would enable every individual to be his own bank. And I mean full-service bank, his own stock brokerage, his own everything, and totally anonymously. And we're moving very quickly toward that. And when we do, the governments of the world are going to be hard-pressed to collect any taxes. You can suggest all kinds of regulatory schemes, but they're mostly not going to work because anything that they regulate will be abandoned by the market or in favor of things that cannot be regulated. So the big clinch will come when we get to legal tender laws. In the United States, we currently have a statute that makes Federal Reserve notes legal tender, although it's only constitutional on state on federal territory, not on state territory. It's worded in a way so people don't realize that. But the crunch is going to come when, first, the government isn't going to be able to collect digital currencies in taxes, and second, people refuse to deal with the government unless it pays them in digital currency. So at some point, there's going to be a flip over when people abandon fiat currencies in favor of digital currencies, or what might be called digital hawalas, from the ancient system that goes back more than 2,000 years.
Any comments on it?
Well, Jim Harper here. I think these prospects are interesting. They're off in the future, maybe even further than the distance between your early call on this happening. It's there will be pressure on some forms of tax collection if Bitcoin allows people to evade, but there's still going to be plenty of opportunity in where somebody has some, you know, a terrestrial operation. That is, if they have a home, that'll be an angle. If they have a business, that'll be an angle. So I think that some of the claims that taxation goes away in a Bitcoin world might be overstated. I think the adoption of Bitcoin will not come as fast as many of us want, and so these are trends that we can look at over probably decades and address them appropriately over that time.
Dean, if there's another question, we'll go to it. If not, I'll
have let me make another call for questions. Push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question, but we don't have any questions pending just now, Vince.
All right. Any comments on the appearance of Bitcoin ATMs in the U.S.? Apparently, there's one in a cigar store in Albuquerque, New Mexico, supposedly, and a couple in Austin, Texas. That just a sign of the integration into the financial system, or is it anything else we should think about or be concerned about with respect to that, Chip?
I don't know if it's a concern. It's certainly an interesting development, and I'm not aware of Bitcoin ATMs, but I'm really not in a position to know that. But assuming that there are Bitcoin ATMs, I don't think there's any generic basis for concern. I would go back to the core principles that I tried to explain at the beginning and pit concerns that folks have, you know, at that level. To say if we don't have adequate transparency over who is acting in the financial system, including those that are at the moment exchanging fiat currency or value for bitcoins, which is really the choke point at which our regulations currently work to extract information at those exchanges about who's buying bitcoin, if those requirements that currently exist are not implemented, then there's a real vulnerability that we don't understand what's happening and who's transacting in the Bitcoin space. I think if those obligations as they currently exist are implemented, then we have real transparency into the exchanges between real-world currency, so to speak, and Bitcoin. There is a remaining vulnerability, which could be relevant here, and that is within the Bitcoin universe, transactions, it's not clear to me that those transactions are being tracked and are traceable outside the ledger, which is obviously public and does account for every transaction and the technology itself. But the identity of those that are conducting those transactions obviously is not available with the transaction. That's a fundamental requirement in the money transmitter space that Bitcoin would ostensibly be subjected to. It's also not something that is, I think, easily imposed, given what I understand about the technology. And it's not something that has been directly addressed, from what I can tell, in the guidance that Treasury has issued to date. But it is something that I think is going to be required in some form or fashion if and as Bitcoin continues to grow. Because it's one thing to say we know who's transacting in Bitcoin because of who's exchanging real value for Bitcoin. It's another to say within the Bitcoin universe, there are now a sufficient level of activity, and there's a sufficient diversity of activity that it's hard to track and trace within that, unless you've got the decoder on the ledger, and that's obviously been very much protected. So, that's a conversation that I think industry and government need to embark on, because there's compelling interest on the government side, but there's also real limitations and maybe alternative possibilities on the technology side on how to address that set of issues. ATMs, depending on whether you're transacting already in the Bitcoin space, may tread on that, or whether it's a convertibility from real to Bitcoin or Bitcoin back, then it's just a compliance issue with what is already clearly on the books.
I'll say, Vince, that I'm excited about Bitcoin ATMs. I think it's a really interesting development, one of many across the Bitcoin ecosystem. Think of a Bitcoin ATM as a two-way ATM. You can put local cash, your local currency, into a Bitcoin and get out Bitcoin. You're given a little slip that gives the public key and private key that reflect the Bitcoin that you then possess. Or you can put Bitcoin into the ATM and get out your local currency. That's important because of the potential use in remittances. Right now, remittances cost sometimes 10% or 15% of the value being sent, and this deeply cuts into what people can send back to their home countries from the United States. One of the major sources of financial well-being for a lot of people around the world is what their relatives send them. But an ATM that allowed them to receive Bitcoin and then take it out in their local currency would cut out that middleman, the existing remittance firms that charge these exorbitant rates, and increase well-being around the world in marked degree fairly quickly. So the more quickly these ATMs can be installed around the world, I think the better for global financial inclusion, for uplift of people. Yes, there are the obligations. The company I know of that is doing Bitcoin ATMs in the U.S. Is fully compliant, and they did a demo on Capitol Hill the other day where they walked through how it's done, including providing identification that's required by use of this ATM. But once somebody has been able to put an ATM in Botswana, an ATM in Argentina, Bolivia, wherever it may be, they can send, money can be sent to people there who can use it to buy things that are precious to them and very valuable. And I think we'll see around the world bringing people into the global financial system will have huge benefits, including security benefits to the United States. The countries that are outside, effectively excluded from the U.S. and Western financial system, are some of the places where danger comes to us from now. And because their economies are so poor, they don't have the funds to create rule of law, stable environment, education, healthcare for the people that live in those places. And that redounds to security threats to us. So I think including more people in the global financial services system is going to be better for them, quite clearly, and we'll have marginal security gains from having a richer world ourselves.
Thank you for those thoughts. I mentioned that we do have to stop. I had a hard stop at 3. I thank both Jim and Chip for giving us an understanding of the world now and the not too distant future, helping us keep up with the mind-numbing velocity of developments in the internet and the virtual world. Thank you for your time, thoughts, and experience, and thank to those who listened in.
Thank you very much, and this is Dean Reuter adding my thanks to Vince Witkowski, our guest moderator. To our audience, please consult the Federalist Society's website for a schedule of upcoming teleforum conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.